Ben, I am so delighted that you are here. Delighted that I am here this afternoon, Saturday afternoon. You come out to hear a message from God's Word. That means I appreciate you a lot. It says something wonderful that you are here. Many of you were here Friday evening and here Saturday, so I appreciate you being here. I appreciate Luke and his help. Did you notice how cleverly he fumbled over here in order to give them time to get the communication? He's very smooth. And he's been very helpful with the PowerPoints, putting as much work on the PowerPoints, I think, as I am in trying to make it available to everyone that is assembled here today. And I understand even some people with Zoom meeting are following along. So I appreciate that. International, that's true. Hovar, I think, was surprised, maybe pleasantly surprised when he got here, but the formal student of mine, as are so many who were assembled here, and I appreciate your presence particularly. We're talking about marriage and family from a biblical perspective. And tonight we talk about the idea of godly love in the family. If in fact you were to ask people, why do you get married? The answer that most people would give today is they get married for love. Now, there are a lot of other answers that they could give and that have been overwhelmingly popular in the past. You get married in order to have children. You get married to fulfill God's commandment to be fruitful and multiply. You get married perhaps for support and encouragement from another person because two are stronger than one. You might get married if you're a man in order to be able to become an elder by having children. But the modern answer that people give is love. And you wonder a little bit what exactly they mean when they say love is the reason to get married. So we ask that question, what is this love that you're saying is the justification for, the motivation for love? And there are lots of attempts people give to answer this question. For instance, someone who can make you laugh on your worst day, and there's probably some value in that. Clearly, shared humor is as critical to a satisfactory marriage and family as any of the other characteristics that we might talk about. It is important that we share together that positive, pleasant feeling. Some will say love is an energy so pure that it makes life want to happen. I have no idea what that means, but it certainly sounds like a good reason to get married. I like this one though, a mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship. If you are a biologist, you understand about symbiosis too, that require the other in order to live as a mutually beneficial relationship. One is not sapping off of the other. A mutually beneficial symbiotic relationship, that's true about marriage. Finding someone who completes your puzzle. Now, I tell you, I enjoy a good puzzle. I really enjoy that eureka experience when you see the answer to the puzzle. And I have to admit that there are occasions when I feel that way about my wife. So, you know, there's got to be some value to that too, finding someone who completes your puzzle. I think the reason people will give this kind of response to what is the kind of love that would motivate you to get married is the fact that they feel like marriages are made up of two people who are deficient in some way, and that they make up in one another what's deficient in the other. That kind of deficiency theory of love, however, doesn't work out very well in point of fact. When people are deficient and they come together because one is a sadist and the other is a masochist, that's not going to be a very pleasant or positive relationship. And in fact, if you have an introvert and someone who's an extrovert in extreme ways, they're just going to aggravate one another in some ways. Much better, probably, if we have two people who are complete and sufficient in themselves and yet find that with the other party, they can be more than they were before. Not because they're deficient, but because they improve one another. And of course, this one is probably another one of those poetic sort of ideas, holding hands in the rain without knowing it's raining. I'm not sure that kind of obliviousness is going to get you very far, but it is pleasant to consider. And then, of course, there is the classic love meetings. Never had the senior sorrow. How many married people here today think that's true? Love means always be willing to say, I'm sorry. So that at least gets us a little bit of the way in which people think about the nature of love that compels people to marry. All of them suggest that it's something out of the ordinary, something special. And in fact, I think when we consider throughout history, in fact, the relationship between a man and a woman in marriage, and it is something special, different than all other kinds of relationships. And the kind of love that leads a man and a woman to bring into the world children and then to care for those children, that's something special and out of the ordinary. Those who have never been blessed by having children somehow don't quite understand what it means when we love our children. In fact, some of you children here today probably have heard your parents say, when you have kids of your own, you'll understand. And in fact, that's probably true. You just don't know what that is like until you actually have experienced it. But when people talk about the motivation to getting married and they say love, what they generally mean is a romantic myth. Idea of romance that somehow has been kind of cobbled together over the centuries and that guides and misdirects in many ways our experiences about dating and marriage in the world today. The romantic myth, romance, of course, is, you know, something that's very kind of elusive, maybe even temporary, sort of pleasant, maybe exciting in some occasions. It's a whole genre of books, in fact, on romance. Romance novels. That makes up probably the majority of the books that are actually written and published in America today. It is what people write poems about. I discovered this the other day. I was in Barnes & Noble. There's a whole shelf devoted to paranormal romances. It's like, well, I mean, we have created this idea that this is the most powerful, important thing in the world. But what people generally mean when they talk about romance is this romantic myth. Number one point that they think they're going to say is there's one and only one soulmate for each person. And the idea would be if you find that one and only one right person, you'll be blissfully happy the rest of your life. If you don't find that one and only one person that's your soulmate, you'll never be really happy in this world. And of course, you know, that's a potent idea. And I would hope that every single married person would say to themselves, convince themselves that the person they're married to is their soulmate. The person who completes their puzzle, the person with whom they can create an energy so pure that it makes life happen. But I think it puts a lot of pressure on us to presume that out of the 8 billion people in the world, divide them up half and half as male and female, out of the 4 billion people in the world, one and only one is going to make you happy. That's pretty hard to live with. And Christians make it even more difficult because they presume that somehow God in his will has already chosen the person that they have to marry in order to please him. That's pretty high pressure that God has placed on this case. I would say this to those who are not married. You ought not to put that kind of pressure on yourself. There are a number of different people who are good, mature, and mentally and emotionally healthy Christians with whom you can make a perfectly satisfying and happy marriage if you work at it in the way that we're going to talk about this evening. The problem with this idea there's one and only one soulmate is, in fact, that we also add to that this idea of love at first sight. You knew the moment you saw it. Your eyes met across the room. And you knew that this is the person that you wanted to spend the rest of your life with. And if that happened to you and you were spending your life happily with that person, God bless you and that relationship. But that's a lot of pressure because sometimes we look at people and we think, this is the one that I think I want to spend my life with. And it turns out not to be the case. And here's what happens. We presume that we have one and only one soulmate with whom we'd be perfectly happy. And we see that person, or at least we think we do, and we get married, and then we're not happy. And then it's like, uh-oh, I messed up. This must not be my soulmate. And what would be more terrifying than the fact that you married this person, and then you walk around the corner a month later, and you see the person that you really are in love with, that you really your one and only soulmate. That's why there's so many divorces in America today. That's not true that you know the first time you see them. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, sometimes we're mistaken. And it's not true that there's one and only one person with whom you can be happy. Put those two things together, and it is corrosive to many marriages in America today. And then add this idea, love, love. Love is all you need. The idea that love is going to wash the dishes, pay the bills, and put the kids to bed at night when they're sick and ill, that's not true either. And you're going to be very disappointed if you think this concept of romance is the end all and be all of a marriage relationship. This romantic myth is not what we're talking about tonight. Psychologists have for a long time understood that in a married relationship, there are two kinds of marital love that they want to talk about. One is passion. The idea maybe gets closer to this idea of romance, that you're stirred in your inner being by the other person. A lot of that, of course, is physical. A lot of it's chemical. It's an attraction to the other person. And that's certainly a part of a marriage relationship. And I hope it's a part of your marriage if you are married, or will be a part of your marriage when you choose to marry. But we also understand that that kind of passion that sometimes takes people as a kind of madness is not something that is of a continuing kind of value, that it ebbs and flows in our lives. At some moments, we're passionately attracted to the other person, but that's too intense an emotion, and it kind of, you know, ebbs away. And it's replaced in marriage by compassionate love, companionate love, the kind of love in which we are comfortable with the other person. We know them, and we know that they know us, and we have things in common, and we can spend our time in companionable activities or even in companionable silence. Sometimes I liken this to the wedding cake, that in fact, passionate love is like the icing on the cake. Compassionate love is like the cake itself. And sometimes I do this with my students. I'll say, which would you prefer, whole the plate full of just icing or the cake by itself? I do have some people sometimes say, give me the icing. But you know, that's going to make you sick after 3 or 4 bites of just plain icing. The cake's pretty good. Of course, the best of all is the cake with the icing on it. And I hope that's the kind of marriage that you can have. But if you had to settle for one, the compassionate kind of love is what will bind two people together and keep them together for an enduring period of time. This modern concept of love is not really what we're concerned about tonight, so much as we're concerned about the idea that the Bible tells us about love. And it really doesn't talk about this kind of romantic notion of love, this passionate concept of love, a lot at all. It's hinted at, of course, in the fact that there are these Greek words, the language in which the Bible was originally written for love, where we use one word, which is really confusing, really confusing. I love my mother. I love pizza. I love my dog. Those are all kinds of love that are really not the same thing at all. We just use the same word for it. In the Greek, they have 5 different words. Word for the kind of love we have in our family, the kind of love that we talk about in the world today, this modern romantic notion of passion, eros. And the Bible does mention that, perhaps. Though the word is not used, the idea is certainly there in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 8 and 9, when it says that it's good to be married if you don't have self-control. Better to marry than to burn with desire, that kind of passion that's a part of the human physiology that needs to be satisfied, more in some people than in others. That's not really what the Bible is concerned about, and certainly not what it's concerned about in thinking about the love that exists between a husband and a wife and parents and children. The biblical word, of course, as you well know, is the word agape. Agape in the Greek is the kind of love that God has for man. For God so loved the world that he gave his own one and only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Agape, that kind of love, is the kind of love that we need to learn and we need to apply to our marriages and to our roles as parents and children. In the King James Version, we don't have the kind of confusion that we have in the modern English translations. A lot of people, knowing about this romantic myth, reading about the word love in the modern translations, think that it's talking about that kind of romantic, passionate sort of attraction. In the King James Version, very frequently agape is translated charity, which seems to us a much milder, a much less powerful word. Truth of the matter is, it's a much more powerful word and needs to be distinguished from this modern romantic myth about passionate love. And in fact, what we find is 1 Corinthians chapter 13 talks about love, this agape love, this charity, in a way in which to make us understand how we ought to treat, feel, engage with those who are members of our own family. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, a chapter with which you are very much familiar. Maybe you could probably even quote this. Obviously, of course, quoting scriptures these days with all the different kinds of translations is fraught with all sorts of difficulties. But in the New American Standard, love is patient, love is kind, it's not jealous, does not brag, is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, it is not provoked, it does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Now you'll understand in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the Apostle Paul is talking about how we ought to relate with and the way we ought to feel about those who are members of our spiritual family. But in many ways, the spiritual family, the family of man, the family of God, is in some ways related to the families that we create when we marry and when we have children. And it's perfectly appropriate to take this passage and to say, how does this apply to me? And how could this improve my marriage relationship, improve my relationship with my children or with my parents? So, the rest of the time available to us, I want to go through and understand what exactly the Holy Spirit is trying to communicate to us about the way in which we ought to love the members of our family. In some ways, this is not the way we think about love because we think about it as an emotion. But in the case of the Bible talking about agape, it's an act. It's things we do. It is the work of love, the enactment of love, as opposed to just having some kind of feeling. And I wonder about that a lot. You know, you hear people, it's like, I don't know. Wife and I watch romance movies sometimes on my channel. And, they get to this intense point and people will say, I love you. It's like, what in the world does that mean? Or even worse, for some of those more dramatic shows where we've got a husband and a wife who are divorcing one another. And then the husband who's leaving the house goes to the child and says, I love you. I'll always be there for you. So what? You're leaving? And now you say you love me? You know, it's a wonder the children don't just spit in their face, and sometimes they do, of course, in real life about that. This is the enactment of love, not an emotion. As I look at that passage, there are eight passive characteristics, things you don't do, and there are seven of these that are positive characteristics, or active characteristics. So when you look at patient or long-suffering, that's the passive aspect of the positive aspect of kindness. Patient, you're putting up with things. Kindness, you're actively doing things for the other person. And so I want to go through these and try and see what we can learn from applying these to marriage and to parent-child relationships, to our families. So Sometimes I do get objections and people say, well, that's not what the passage is about. The passage is about the way in which we treat our brethren in the church. But again, I would emphasize brethren in the church, the family of God, that's an appropriate application. But we learn about what it means to be a part of the family of God from the families that we have. We learn about what it means to have God who is a father in heaven from the fathers that we have on earth. We learn about what it means to be brethren in church from the paternal relationships we have in the family. So if in fact that's the case, and I think it goes all the way back to creation, then we can take this passage about the spiritual family and use it to improve our own families here in this world. So with that kind of justification, whether that satisfies you or not, you can write your question chat about that if you want. Luke, you know, made an optimistic promise that I would answer the questions. But I've already told him, you know, you can read the questions. You know, I may answer them, I may try to answer them, or I may just say, yeah, pass up them. In fact, I worried all night about the questions I got last night. I mean, I should have done this, I should have done that, I should have done the other. And then I said, no, I got to worry about the next four of us coming up. So can't dwell on that. First of all, let me say that this idea of suffers long suffering, or patient, is critically important in human relationship and certainly in the intense, close relationship that we have in our families. It's kind of passive. You put up with things, as opposed to kindness, which is acting, you accomplish things. In a relationship as intense as marriage, there's always going to be an opportunity to be offended. There's always going to be an opportunity to feel like you need to get back some of your own. And there is always in that relationship the power to avenge a wrong that has been suffered. But patience or long suffering does not avail itself of those opportunities to go tit for tat and hurt their feelings just because they hurt yours. My dad used to say to me, my dad was a contractor, and we boys, we grew up working with him after school. I never had any other jobs. Dad would pick us up. We'd go to work, all summer long, work together, and we got to know one another pretty well. And as I got older, you know, it's a little bit of tendency to be a teenager to push back. And my dad would say, look, son, don't argue with me. I know too much about you. It took me until I was 30 before I realized, hey, I know too much about you too. That's the nature of family. We know everybody's weak points. We know exactly how to provoke the other person. We know exactly how to get even with them. Do not avail yourself of that opportunity. The first characteristic of love is, even if you feel wrong, you do not revenge yourself, even if you have the power to do that, which you do. Relationships have a momentum. And if, in fact, one person hurts the other person's feeling, and then they engage in some retribution about that, the momentum is down. Let's make that momentum upward. Ignore the bad things. If they do something good or compliment you, then reinforce that. Go ahead and tit for tat with that, as opposed to in getting even when they hurt your feelings. Love is willing, in fact, to wait. And of course, there's no better example in the Bible of waiting, in fact, the love relationship than Jacob, who served 7 years for Rachel, and it seemed only a few days because of the great love that he had for her. If you really loved somebody, you'd put up with their shortcomings. And we say we love one another when we get married. Let's keep that going by putting up with the things that they do that upset us. On the other hand, we need to be kind. We need to do positive kinds of things. Love is sweet. It is not apt to criticize. It is more apt to encourage. The worthy woman in Proverbs chapter 31 and in verse 26 is said to have the law of kindness on her lips. The law of kindness. that she governs what she says according to this law. If it's kind, I will say it. If it's not kind, I will not say it. That's the way we ought to all be in our families. We ought to be kind to one another. If you can't be kind to the people that are your closest relations in the world, how are you going to be kind to anybody else? We need to be sensitive to the other person and to be taking care of their feelings as opposed to treading on their feelings. And you need to have that kind of virtue of being sensitive to a person who's kind to you. Unfortunately, because of whatever kinds of parenting situations they come out of, or whatever kinds of worldly situation they come out of, some women seem to prefer men who are not particularly kind. They like the bad boys. They like the ones that are a little rough. That may be exciting when you come out of a well-balanced household and be exciting for a little while, but that bodes ill in the future. You want to find somebody who is kind, and you want to be kind as well. And for this, I think of Ruth and Boaz. That Boaz was drawn to Ruth because of the kindness that she had shown to her mother-in-law. And of course, the reason we know the story of Ruth and Boaz is because they were in the lineage of the Christ. Not just physically in the lineage of the Christ, but in the lineage of the Christ because of this kind of kindness that they expressed toward one another. And I think, too, about Rebecca. And how when Abraham had sent his trusted servant to find a husband, a wife for his son Isaac, that in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 14, he prays to God and he says, when I ask a young woman to give me a drink of water, and she says, please drink this water and I will draw water for your camels as well, then I will know that you've appointed this woman to be the wife to my servant Isaac. And he says, by this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. We ought to be the kind of husband and the kind of wife and the kind of children and the kind of parents that can be said to be the kindness of God to our family members. Do people look at you as the kindness that God has shown to those who are members of your family? Closely associated with that, does not envy, does not begrudge the other person the good things that happen to them. In fact, the very essence, I think, of love is the willingness to share our resources with the other person. Would you give them the last? I knew I loved them. I love coconut green butter. Not custard. That's okay. Coconut cream pie. I love coconut cream pie. And when I let one have the last piece of coconut cream pie, I said, what is wrong with me? And I knew I'm in love because I was willing to give her that last piece of pie. Another translation has this, is not jealous. Now, of course, it is perfectly appropriate for a husband and a wife, each expect exclusivity in that relationship. God is a jealous God. He expects us to be loyal to him. And we can expect and have every right to expect that our wife or our husband is loyal to us. But we are not jealous without a cause. We trust the other person. And consequently, we don't disparage the kind of relationships they may have with other people that gives them some kind of satisfaction, as long as we're confident about that exclusivity. Love is not arrogant. It doesn't parade itself about, as some translations have. It doesn't brag. It's not puffed up. It's always aware of its own unworthiness. When you love somebody, you feel unworthy of it. Now, I know this flies into the face of the modern wisdom that emphasizes self-esteem. And the idea, somebody discovered in the 1960s, that when the Bible says we should love our neighbors ourselves, it's actually telling us we first got to learn how to love ourselves enough so that we can love other people. That's not what that passage is talking about. The Bible teaches humility. It teaches a sense of unworthiness. And in a marriage relationship, you better learn to wake up each morning and to say, what did I do to deserve this person? Because when you wake up in the morning and you say, I could have done better, that marriage relationship is in real trouble. You need to be aware of your own unworthiness, to be thankful for the person that God has given you in your life. And because of that thankfulness, to treat them as if they are special and as if they're worthwhile. We ought never to be arrogant and think of ourselves as superior to the other person. I would add this about the parent-child relationship too. It's easy enough for children, once they get a little bit of age and they start visiting in other homes, to think to themselves, I wish I had these parents instead of the parents that I have. Be thankful for the parents that you've got. They're the ones who brought you to the world. They want to have taken care of you to this point in your life. And they deserve some thankfulness for that. And if you're a parent, it may well be that the neighbors down the street, their child walked first, their child talked first. It may be that their children are athletic. It may be their children are going to make course and your children aren't. But be thankful for the ones that you have. Be thankful that God has blessed you with the family that you have. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse, chapter 3 and verse 8. Finally, all of you should be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love one another as brothers. Be tenderhearted. Be courteous. Love is never rude. It is not going to act in a way that's unbecoming. It's not going to act in a way that offends the other person. Love is courteous. I wonder about this. Have you ever observed in your household, when guests come over, that you're more courteous to them than you are to your own family members that you live with on a day-to-day basis? You go to the refrigerator and you get something to drink. If there's guests in the house, you ask them, do they want something? Do you ask that of your spouse or your parents or your children? Are we courteous? Do we say thank you and you're welcome? My wife actually has some relatives, and they'd adopted some children from Bulgaria. And these two girls were already teenagers by the time they got them. And they were trying to talk to them about the way in which they would conduct themselves. And they were trying to emphasize, particularly say thank you and you're welcome. And they were having a hard time about that. They had grown up in a kind of hardscrabble existence in those orphanages, and it was hard. And Johnny had told me the story, and then we were there visiting with them, and they have a big family, and whenever there's something going on, they'll just kind of spontaneously have a big family dinner. And so they got the tables all put together, maybe 15 people all across the table, and there's this thing going on. Would you pass us off, please? Thank you. You're welcome. And they're passing over these two girls' eyes, and I see those girls as well in their eyes. So pure, people are not that kind. They're not that courteous. We need to have manners and be courteous to one another inside the marriage relationship. There's a kind of a deference that is due to those people that are most important to us. And we need to express that deference in our lives. Love does not seek its own, does not insist on its own way. Perhaps the essence of marital love is the willingness to seek the other's good, not your own. Sometimes I worry about that when I hear young people and they say how much they love this person and, how passionate they are. And I wonder exactly what they mean when they say, I love you. It seems like maybe what they mean is I love you really means I love me and I want you for me so you'll make me happy. That's not really what love is all about. Love insists on helping the other person, even at one's own expense. It doesn't insist on getting its own way, especially when that's going to cost the other person. If you are a young person and you're dating, particularly young ladies, and you're dating, and the young guy says, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, says it endlessly, and then he asks you to do something or act in a way that is going to ruin your character or your relationship with your parents, or worse than that, even your relationship with the Lord. He does not really love you. You just need to understand that's the case. Give him up. Sometimes students will say, well, you can forgive him. I said, fine, forgive him, but don't marry him, because he's already demonstrated what his character is. Maybe he can reform, but you know, do not spend any more time with that young man. True love never harms the beloved and never acts out of selfishness in such a way to request that they engage in behaviors that are going to cause them some kind of harm. We should have, as Paul says in Philippians chapter 2, the mind of Christ. Have this mind in you that Christ had. Do nothing out of selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, think better of others than you do of yourself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but for the interests of others. If we're to do that in terms of a congregation, we surely ought to be doing that for our husbands and our wives and our children. Love is not irritable. Well, I wish I could leave this one out. Because that's a real problem I have, is I get irritable. And sometimes I say, oh, my, sad again. I learned that from my elderly ancestors when I was younger. Oh, my sad again. And now I know what sad it really is. And it's like, you know, but I'm just plain irritable. And I struggle with that. And, I think as I get older, I've kind of settled down some. And then the next thing you know, I'm irritable again. But, don't do as I say, do as I do here. Don't lose your temper with the people that you love the most, because it just does so much damage. Angry words, oh, let them never from the tongue unbridled slip. Angry words, lightly spoken, bitterest thoughts, rashly stirred. Brightest links of life are broken by a single angry word. Drummond, an essayist from the 19th century, says, no form of vice or worldliness, not greed, not drunkenness itself, does more to unchristianize society than an evil temper. And I think maybe that's true. If you love somebody, you're patient with them. We've already talked about that. You're not irritable, you don't get angry with them. You are willing to forbear with whatever it is that you don't think is appropriate at this moment in time. You know who's irritable? That I can tell you. I mean, I know that fault in myself. Is people who are self-centered. We're grouchy when things don't go to suit ourselves. And that's when we get short-tempered with other people. Yes, Christ was angry at times, but Christ was never irritable. He had a reason for his righteous indignation. It wasn't out of some kind of self-centeredness or feeling that he'd been shortchanged. And in our relationship with our parents, with our children, our relationship with our parents, we need to be careful that we don't have that kind of irritability and anger that ruins those relationships. Love keeps no account of evil. I'll tell you, this is the one that, if you're following along in your various translations, has the most variety of translations, this underlying Greek phrase here. I think maybe keeps no account of evil comes closest to what the actual Greek suggests. It's an accounting term, we're marking those things down. And it's possible, of course, as we go through life, to keep a tally. This person's done me more favors. This person's done me more injuries. One of the things that is most disappointing to me about David in the scriptures, and of course that great sin with Bathsheba just shattered his life. But to me, the most sad aspect of David's life is when he's on his deathbed and he calls Solomon in and he says, don't you remember about this person did that, Joab did this, don't let him get away with this, and Shimei did this, and he needs to be put out for that. And he lays on Solomon the retribution for all of those injustices. And some of that happened years before, and he wants him to take advantage of those people and to repay them for those things. We ought not to keep account of those kinds of injustices that people have committed against us. We go through this life, there are going to be people in the street. There are going to be people that offend you. Some are unpleasant sometimes. Some actually cheat you. That's just the way the life is in this world of sin and woe here below. But we cannot store those things up and wait for the moment in which we're going to be able to get even. And particularly not with those that we love the most. That's one of the things about loving, is we put up with those things, patient, long-suffering, not rude, willing to share our resources, willing to forgive and forget those transgressions against us. Injustice claim. Maybe you know some people like this. Take a drive around the town with them. They live there very long. Say, I don't shop there anymore because they did a bad job on my tires. I don't shop there anymore because they gave me the bad change one time and I tried to talk to them about it and they just insisted it was my fault. And you go through town in every place, you know, it's like you're going to have to move pretty soon if there's no other places you can shop. Injustice collectors, they just keep those things stored up and they can give you a long testimonial about how bad people are in this town. Even worse is the idea they can do that in their family members. One of the things that happens very frequently in a marriage relationship is we live with one another 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 44 years. Is there a lot of things that go on? But you need to put those things away. Forget those things. Don't just keep carrying that list around with you. It's like the man's supposed to meet his wife for lunch, and she's late. And when she gets there, and here's the bill, he says, you're late. Again, you're always late. Every time we go out to eat, you're late. And not only are you late, you also ran the credit card over and got to pay the bill this month. And I got in the car this morning, and I had to stop and get gas because you let it run out of gas. And the dishes are always dirty in the sink. And on and on and on, he's got all of these injustices built up in his mind. Well, there's no way she can respond to that. It's just going to be ugly argument about the point. You need to put those things aside. And we need to do that, whether we're talking about our spouse or we're talking about our children. Well, one of the things that happens very frequently is children don't do what they're supposed to do. That's why they call them children. And you need to learn to be patient with that. And yes, they need some correction. Sometimes maybe they even need punishment, but that's this account. And now we're done with that. And you don't bring it back to mind the next time they do something that they weren't supposed to do. 9, love rejoices in the truth, not in unrighteousness. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity. It doesn't rejoice in the unpleasant things that happen to people. The Germans have a word for that, Schadenfreude. That is, you kind of take a perverse pleasure in the fact that something bad has happened to somebody else. Well, maybe that's okay. If something happens in national politics, you know, I'm like, okay, maybe, I don't know. They're not of my affiliation and they don't have the same ideas. I'm like, yeah, that's good comeuppance to them. But not in the family, not with the people that we love. We ought to be sad when they're sad and happy when they're happy. We ought not to want them to be hurt at all. We ought to work, in fact, in order to prevent those injustices from occurring to them. Even if it's just, we ought to prevent those bad things from happening to them. We ought to rejoice in the good things that happen to them, not in the bad things that happen to them. We need to rejoice in those good things, as Philippians chapter 4 says, whatever is good, whatever is pure, whatever is noble, whatever is just, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good report, these are the things that you ought to think on. These are the things you ought to meditate about. Just think how much difference it makes in a relationship when, in fact, we keep track of the good things the person does. Think about those things. Take those into our heart and our mind. That's the picture we see of them, as opposed to trying to think about the bad things they've done and the bad things that have happened to them and rejoicing in those. Love, as the Holy Spirit moves the Apostle Paul to eloquence, there's not always true of the Apostle Paul in some of his epistles, moves him to eloquence as he writes about this, gets these you know, these last rousing kind of endorsements about love. Love bears all things. Love rejoices in the good things, and it bears all things, endures all things, puts up with all things. Love is not turned aside by trivialities. Love is not turned aside by the barriers by which we may need to get to the person that we love. We may have to go through some difficulties in our dating relationship. We may have to go through some difficulties in life to make it work out so that we can live together in our families and be secure in whatever kind of financial situations we're concerned about. We talk about climb every mountain, swim every ocean, cross every river. Love is not turned aside by the trivialities of life. It puts up with whatever it has to put up with for the sake of the other person. It is not turned aside. You see, the way in which God talks about the love that he has for the nation of Israel in Hosea. And, you know, you want to have silence in the auditorium, preach about Hosea. You know, I used to think one of the worst things was people didn't pay attention to the sermon. And then I preached a sermon on Hosea as I was going through the minor prophets, and everybody was paying attention. And I was like, maybe there are worse things. Not paying attention to the sermon sometimes. But the point of that is to say, God loved them despite their idolatries, and he puts it in the most stark and glaring terms that he possibly can. That's the kind of love that we ought to have for the other person. We have pledged ourselves to the other person, as we discussed in the lesson last night. And it doesn't matter whether they fulfill their part of the bargain or they keep their promises or not. We are not turned aside any more than God was turned aside from Israel by their sins and their idolatries. We bear with one another in love, as Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 2 says. Love believes all things about the other person. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5 through 7, the Christian graces, starts with faith, and it builds on that all of these other characteristics of what it means to be a Christian, all the way up to godliness and brotherly kindness and love. Love is based on the foundation of faith. If you're not married, then you need to find somebody that you can believe in, that you can trust. Once you have chosen that person, you need to have confidence in them. You need to believe in them. You need to love them through whatever kind of difficulties and circumstances occur. Love is based on trust. Marriage is possible only where there's trust and hope for the other person. Where trust fails, the relationship fails. Love is not suspicious. There's a illustration I read about this passage some time ago. And boys in one of those English boarding schools were talking about the various teachers, the masters there, and they said to one another, "It's a shame to tell old Rumpy a lot." And the young boy said, "Well, why is that?" And he said, "It's a shame to tell old Rumpy a lie because he always did." We need to be that kind of person in relationship to our spouse. We need to be that kind of person in relationship to our parents and our children. Trust is perhaps the most important of these characteristics to apply to our children. Responsibility encourages trust, but trust encourages responsibility as well. One of the things that we learn over and over in educational setting is you set high expectations, and students will manage to get closer to that. You set low expectations, they manage to get close to those. And I don't know if that's true. Students generally work hard enough to get a letter grade lower than the one they want. That's right. But we need to have trust for our kids, because they'll get close to it. Yeah, maybe they're not going to do perfectly and do what we think, but we need to trust them to do the right thing, because trust breeds and encourages responsibility. Love hopes all things. It is not discouraged. It doesn't hope all things by juggling reality. Love understands the shortcomings of the person that you love, but it's always hoping for better. It's hoping for reform. It's hoping for transformation. it grasps the heart and the soul of the loved one, and it understands that person was made for honesty and gentleness and sweetness and kindness, and there can be transformed, and that I'm going to be a part of the work in which they are transformed into what they were intended to be and what they are meant to be and what they really are deep inside. We think about that with our children, and we think about that surely with our husband and our wife. Even if they haven't quite got there yet, we hope that for them, and we never give up on them. And finally, love endures all. It puts up with it all. And really, you know, isn't there a theme to all of this? Because we started with patience or long suffering. We end up with endures all things. This is the enactment of love, the work of love. It's not about some kind of passionate sort of feeling. It's not about some kind of glowing energy that makes life happen. It is about the work that we put into our relationship because we have chosen this person and they have chosen us, and we put in the work necessary to make that relationship what it's supposed to be and to help them to be what they're supposed to be. And by doing that, we make ourselves better at what we're supposed to be. I'll refer once again to the pop culture comment, you know, I will be there for you. I hear that comment all the time in movies. And what does it mean? I'll be there for you. I don't understand it, but I wish that they understood what it means. Because if I'm going to be there for you, I'm not leaving and saying I'll be there for you when I walk out the door. It means that I have chosen you and I'm going to do everything I can to make you better, to help you improve. It's a sustaining power. It gives us the ability to endure, to put up with whatever things are going to occur in that relationship. God does not give up on us. God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. He never gives up on us. And we take that as a model for the kind of love that we ought to have for one another in our family relationships. Well, there is so much more in this passage, and I have just kind of skipped over the top, but I've used up all the time. You've been very patient. I appreciate your attention. And I hope the lesson has been of some value to you.
Thank you, Thaxter. So many good things. And of course, when we have all these thoughts based in God's word, it's like a mirror, hopefully, for each one of us, where we see the things, not just in the other person, but the things we need to see in ourselves. So many opportunities, potential for growth. Would a couple young men collect, go ahead and collect any cards, questions. If you have a question you'd like to ask Thaxter, please write it down on the cards we distributed. We'll pick those up right now. We'll take about a 3-minute break to look over the questions, and then we'll finish with him answering some of those questions. We may or may not have time to get to all of them today. And then after we have the questions, we'll have a song and a prayer to conclude our time together. So if you have a question that you've written down, please hold the card, hold it up, and someone will collect that. And we'll just take, again, about a 3-minute break. If you don't need water or the restroom, please stay seated. If you need to go to the restroom, need a drink, you can do that right now. And then we'll finish in just a few minutes with some of these questions. Any other questions to collect? Okay, let's take about 3 minutes and then we'll finish up our time here. Long answer, but we'll see. Okay.
Yes and no.
Yes and no. Let's start with this one. Okay. Which traits should my future spouse have if I want to marry that person?
Well, that's an easy one. I talk about that quite a bit. Probably the most important characteristic you would want in a spouse is confidence, because you're going to need it. Because we all fall short. And you look for somebody, you marry somebody that's looking for the perfect spouse, then you're in trouble, probably, because you're going to have to spend the rest of your life trying to measure up to that. We need somebody who's willing to, as we started with, suffer long and endures all things. You need somebody who's going to put up with your shortcomings.
Okay, here's another one. What is the significance of love never fails?
Well, I think like many of these things, it's aspirational. It points us in the direction that we're supposed to go, because we learn about love from God's love of us. I express, first of all, as Hosea suggested, in this endurance of all the kinds of foibles, sins, idolatries of Israel, and then express most completely in his loving us enough to send his only begotten son to redeem us from our sins. That's what we aspire to in our own relationships. That, as I suggested last night, marriage is a covenant relationship in which we have pledged ourselves to the other person, not contingently based on the fact of whether it continues to be a favorable relationship or whether they fulfill their obligations, but we are going to love them regardless of the future circumstances. That's why it's important to choose wisely. And that's why with emphasis, I think, in 1 Corinthians 13, starts with long-suffering patience and ends with endures all things and never fails.
Here's one that makes a reference to 2 Peter 1, verse 4. And the question is marriage meant to prepare us to be partakers of the divine nature? And again, it references 2 Peter 1, verse 4.
Yeah, I thought about that. That's an interesting question, and I'm not altogether sure about the answer about that. But I think my first cut at that question would be that marriage is no more specifically intended to help us be partakers of the divine nature than any of the other activities that we engage in this life. That what that passage is referring to, of course, is the promises that we have through Jesus Christ of redemption, purification, justification, ultimately culminating in the fact that when we see Christ, when he comes again, we will be just as he is. We'll be fully partakers of the divine nature at that point. All the activities that occur in this life, whether it's in terms of friendship, or whether it's in terms of the injustice that we experience, or whether it is in our marriage relationship, are opportunities for us to demonstrate the developing character of Christ in our lives. The reason I don't say that marriage specifically prepares us for the divine nature, I'm not sure what the status of marriage is in heaven, based on Jesus saying that in heaven we neither marry nor give in marriage, but we'll be like the angels are. That's a big disappointment to most of us, given the close connection that we have with our spouses in this life. So I'm a little uncertain maybe to say that marriage more specifically than any other relationships prepares us to be partakers of the divine nature.
Here's one more. What is the responsibility of the church when it's apparent godly love is not present in the family? It leads to the detriment of that family unit or the detriment of their children, or even bringing reproach on the church. What's the responsibility of the church in that situation?
Big question. I think, Henderson Boulevard had a summer series based on really that general concept. What's the responsibility of the church for developing purity and holiness in the individual members? We probably don't give in this modern society enough credence to the fact that we are part of a community when we are part of a church, and that as part of that kind of holy community, we have a responsibility to one another, which means, of course, that when one of our members is suffering in some way, that one of our members is falling short of the kind of life of holiness they ought to exhibit, that we have a responsibility to go to them and encourage them and instruct them, and even sometimes, in the case of church discipline, to rebuke them about those things. Unfortunately, in this world beset by sin, sometimes we can't redeem everybody, and that would be true about the marriage relationships that people have and the destructive kind of behaviors that cause the deterioration of those marriages. But I think we have a mutual responsibility to one another, set the right example, teach and encourage, and maybe on some occasions, to, as Matthew 18 suggests, go to them privately, maybe take a couple of other people with them if the issue is escalated to that level. We certainly have a responsibility to one another in the marriage, family relationship, as in all others.
Okay. That's probably good for now. We need to have our time come to a close. There are some questions we did not get to, but if whether or not really directly related to the subject or time, or maybe just the wording was not clear what the question was. But if you have another question, I'm sure he'd be happy to speak with you afterward for a few minutes. At this time, we'll go ahead and conclude with a song. Tim, if you want to go ahead and come forward, and we'll have a prayer led by, is Phil here? Okay, Phil Duren, one of our members, will lead us in a prayer in just a minute. Thank you again, Baxter, for a very wonderful time considering these things. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts and insights with us on the basis of God's word. Tomorrow is our final day. We have, Baxter will be teaching another session during our Bible class, which begins at 9 a.m. here. He'll also present the sermon tomorrow in our worship at 10. And then our final session is tomorrow afternoon at 5:30. And so everyone is welcome to attend any of those. We will not be doing questions and answers in the morning, but our final session tomorrow at 5:30, we'll have one more opportunity for questions and answers like this. So let's go ahead and have our final song with Tim Dow leading us, and then Phil will conclude our time in prayer. Yes?
Junior high and high school classes will be in the auditorium.
Okay. Tomorrow morning, junior high and high school, you've heard that, be in the auditorium instead of your classes. Let me mention one final thing. The lessons are being recorded and being placed on the North Terrace website. So if you would like to listen to these again later, or if you would like a copy of the PowerPoints, Baxter said he's happy to share them. So see me if you would like that. I have all those, and you can go to our website and listen to the sermons, the lessons again later. Tim?
Final song this evening. It's going to be in our Spanish hymnal. You have several blue hymnals in your queue. This one is called Cantos de Divina. We're going to sing number 85 in that hymnal. Number 85. Now we're going to sing only verses 1, 3, 4, and 5. Verses 1, 3, 4, and 5. Let's go ahead and stand for this song, the final song. Yeah.
As we live in this life, your willingness as we come to you to be our Father in heaven and to forgive us of our sins and to work.